Rudy Schaefer, Director of Environmental Education for the California Department of Education and the 1976 President of the Alliance for Environmental Education, comments.
It gives me great pleasure to present parts 1 and 2 of our 4E series. Education is the mechanism for understanding the interrelationships of the 4Es: energy, environment, economics, and ethics. This understanding is essential if solutions to problems in these areas are to be found. The first two parts of this series, Energy Crisis, What We Can Do, will deal mainly with the understanding of the energy shortage, tips on energy conservation, and an introduction to energy economics.
Energy crisis, how can you be? Energy crisis, how can you be? In a country rich as we, in a country rich as we, how can you be?
What has been happening in our country in recent years concerning energy?
Just a couple of years ago, we had gas lines from blocks to miles long in our cities.
We saw how inflation and recession recently crippled us. The $70 million that go out of our country every day to pay for imported oil add to the problem and could be better used to create jobs in the United States and strengthen our economy.
What kind of crisis is this? What's going on?
Is it real? Was it contrived?
What can we do?
We hear of the need for a national energy program. There are many different versions of what this should be. We will try to understand this problem.
Let's go back to January 1974, at the height of the Arab embargo. At that time, current Secretary of the Treasury, William Simon, was the first administrator of the FEA, the Federal Energy Administration. He said at that time,
"Many people don't believe there's a shortage, but let me assure you the shortage is not contrived. Certainly it's not contrived that the demand for energy in the United States has been growing at a rate of 4 to 5% a year for the past 20 years. It's not contrived that if the present trend continues, our energy needs by 1990 will be twice as great as they were in 1973. It's not contrived that domestic exploration peaked in 1956 or that production peaked in 1970. All these things are real, and they've led us to our current problem. The very fact that even with the embargo, we're importing about 5 million barrels a day, and post-embargo we'll import 7 million barrels a day, which shows the imbalance between supply and demand.
We use about 18 million barrels of oil a day in the United States, and about 7 million of that is imported from various regions of the world.
Just so we understand, one barrel of oil is equal to 42 gallons. The average man, woman, and child in the United States each uses about 4 gallons of oil per day.
Hearings held in 1974 in Washington, D.C. by the United States Senate Subcommittee on Investigations determined that the energy shortage was real. Senator Percy commented at that time,
"I personally believe that these hearings have helped to establish that the energy crunch which this nation is now experiencing is neither a phony nor a fraud. It is real. We may not be in a true crisis situation, but we are experiencing an energy shortage of serious proportion, and all indications point to a continuing shortage over the next several years. Absent a foreseeable change of circumstances, perhaps through the next decade, and it's not going to affect just energy and oil. It's going to affect many of the raw materials that this entire industrial nation depends upon for its economic health and growth."
The energy problem is international.
If anything was needed to illustrate the interdependence of nations in this world, it is what has happened in the field of energy. No single country is capable of solving the problem by itself. Indeed, no group of countries, as between consumers and producers, can solve the problem by themselves. Today concerns energy, but that in the future may concern other raw materials or foodstuffs where incentives for supply are out of proportion to the demand.
We are told that fuel shortages will be around for a long time. What can we do to save energy?
We need a change in lifestyle. How does one change a lifestyle? Let's start with the car.
About one-third of all automobile driving is for commuting to and from work, and is usually only one person to a car. If we could just increase this average by one person, we'd save almost 750,000 barrels per day.
Gonna save a barrel, save another barrel of oil.
Observe the speed limit of 55 miles per hour. Most autos get 10 to 20% more miles per gallon at 55 miles per hour than they do at 70. Let us remember that the midwinter estimated shortage of oil due to the embargo was 2.7 million barrels per day.
If we follow just these three tips, one extra person per commuter car, 1 gallon of gas less per week, and driving at 55 miles per hour, we would save 1.25 million barrels per day, almost half of the entire embargo-related shortage.
One plus from the energy crisis involves safety.
Changes in travel and speed characteristics resulting from the energy crisis were primary forces behind this reduction of deaths. The actual number of lives saved in 1974 and 1975 was about 10,000 each year.
Another future alternative is the electric car or bus. This could be one of the answers to city transportation when the battery technology has been perfected.
Here we shift from the burning of gasoline to electric power. The electric industry says that it is this shifting from a dependence on oil and gas to more plentiful energy sources, such as coal and nuclear, that is necessary if we are to deal effectively with the energy crisis.
Let's examine our lifestyle at home. We should run air conditioning equipment only on really hot days. On other summer days, open the windows. When using the air conditioner, set thermostat at 78 degrees.
Close draperies and shades in sunny windows in the summer and keep them open in the winter. In the winter months, we should lower heating thermostats to 68 degrees during the day and 60 degrees at night.
Caulk and weather strip doors and windows. This is an inexpensive thing which the homeowner can do himself.
Install storm windows or plastic sheets.
Insulate your attic. It's relatively easy to do and is a good investment.
With the practice of these three insulation measures, we can save about 1.2 million barrels of oil per day, almost half of the embargo-related shortage.
Gonna save a barrel, save another barrel of oil.
An environmentalist, Larry Moss, former president of the Sierra Club, comments on the energy crisis.
There's going to be a lot more attention given to conservation of energy and raw materials, something that conservationists have been calling for a long time. There'll be more emphasis on the reuse of so-called waste materials, in other words, garbage, which will additionally save energy. We see a situation where over the next few years, people will re-examine the way they've used energy and tend to shift from the use of energy for wasteful or low-value applications to using it where it's really important for high-value uses.
We've mentioned only a few ways to conserve energy. If we'd practice these few tips, we would save the equivalent of 3 million barrels of oil per day. That's more than the 1974 embargo-related shortage.
We must reduce our dependence on foreign oil. It still makes us vulnerable as we are dependent on foreign, expensive, insecure oil for 40% of our supply.
Therefore, conservation methods must always be practiced.
Energy crisis. How can you be? Energy crisis. How can you be? In a country rich as we, in a country rich as we, how can you be?
What are our long-range energy plans?
We must push forward in the development of our domestic energy resources. This includes further development of oil and gas in Alaska and the outer continental shelf, greater utilization of coal, of which we have a supply that's unmatched by any other country, further development of oil, shale, and nuclear power. We have also talked for years about the development of such relatively distant alternatives to fossil fuels as fusion, geothermal, and solar. For the next decade, these alternatives are still very much in the R&D stage of growth, and they could not come into widespread use until after 1990. Although we have to invest in the development of these alternatives, our primary focus now must be on the nearer term measures for expanding energy supplies.
We depend on oil and gas for over 3/4 of our energy needs. As these resources become more scarce, we must reserve them for their other uses. That is, the starting ingredients in other manufacturing processes, what we call the petrochemical feedstocks. Here, oil and gas are necessary in the making of drugs, aspirin, insulation, clothing, pharmaceuticals, fertilizer, and many other products.
Let's now look at the economic side of the energy problem. John Winger, director of the Energy Economics Division of the Chase Manhattan Bank, comments on energy economics.
There is a close relationship between economic activity and the use of energy. Indeed, there is not a single business that does not depend upon energy to some degree. Therefore, the future economic activity of the United States or any other nation in the world depends upon the use of energy and the availability of energy. The supply of energy, any form of energy, whether it's oil, coal, nuclear power, or any exotic source, is directly dependent upon the investment made to provide that supply. If the capital investment is too small, a shortage will be the inevitable consequence.
Dr. John Gustafson, past president of the Alliance for Environmental Education and chairman of the Biological Sciences Department at the State University of New York, comments.
For us to understand the complex energy problem, we must look at our choices with an open mind and without bias. This fairness is part of the 4E ethics. Big corporations are often an easy target for attack. Some of their critics claim that their profits are too high. They can manipulate the economy and the country too easily. However, is this the case? Are these criticisms just or are they inaccurate? Are corporations being criticized because they are big and it is popular to attack a giant? We must apply the principle of fairness of the 4E, ethics, in examining this economic question. Let us begin with the oil industry, since these first two film strips relate to the oil shortage and oil conservation. We are hearing proposals which would break up the large oil companies. Some of the arguments say they prevent competition. Let us begin by listening to different viewpoints of the competition argument. We have chosen Senator Birch Bayh, who has introduced legislation to break up the major oil companies, and Mr. Caswell Silver, president of a small oil company.
In the petroleum industry, we have a relatively few large multinational corporations that have control over all segments of the petroleum industry. Production, transportation, that's pipelines and tankers, refining and retail sales. Because of this, there isn't the kind of competition that's necessary really to keep the price of petroleum down. This is compounded by the fact that we now have an international cartel of OPEC nations that are establishing an arbitrarily high international price. And one of the things that could be accomplished by breaking up the oil company's vertical integration is to begin to bring competitive pressure on the OPEC nations. Right now, we're treating them as if they were all one nation. They have different needs. Some of them need the revenue very desperately, and some don't. And if we had the kind of competition within the petroleum industry that we should have, we could play one nation off against the other.
We have chosen Cass Silver to give the opposing viewpoint. He is a prominent petroleum geologist, an independent oil man, president of the small Sundance Oil Company. Definitely not one of the major oil companies.
Some people have said that the oil industry is one big cartel and there is no competition. As a matter of fact, I've been in the oil business 30 years, and it's the most competitive business there is. I've watched the major companies competing against each other and the independents, and there are no hold bars. They go after competing pieces of property or competing areas just as hard as they can without regard to what the other major company uses. There's more competition in the petroleum industry in the United States than in any other industry. With 8,000 to 10,000 independent operators controlling 80% of the drilling in the United States, it's absurd to think that there's no competition. The independents drill about 80% of the wells in the United States. However, the major companies drill the deeper and more expensive wells, which find the bigger fields. So that the major companies generally find about 50% of the oil and the independents 50%. So you might look at it in another way and say that 50% of the oil produced in the United States is dependent upon the independent exploration.
We began these energy film strips with the 1974 remarks of Energy Chief William Simon. At this point, we will listen to his later remarks as Secretary of the Treasury, as he now talks about capital investment and profits. Symbolically, Secretary Simon's prior and present positions help illustrate the interrelationship between energy and economy.
Capital investment is thus the key to maintaining a strong industrial base in this country. How and where the capital for the energy industry will be obtained in the coming years is not yet clear. But it is apparent that one important source must be company profits. All sectors of our economy must have adequate profits in order to have both the incentive and the wherewithal for new investment. While no sector of the economy should reap unjust rewards, we must avoid regulation and legislation that is punitive of profits honestly earned. One of your greatest challenges is to help the American people understand that there is a difference between profiteering and profit making.
We hope you are learning about the four E's. However, we must apply what we have learned into action. Therefore, another aspect of the fourth E, ethics, is both our duty to vote and to monitor our elected officials and their stand on bills during their term in office. If we understand environmental, energy, and economic issues, we can vote on these issues intelligently.
Charles Roth, Director of Education for the Massachusetts Audubon Society and the President-elect of the Alliance for Environmental Education, comments.
In closing, I would point out that both ecology and economy have the same Greek root, oikos, meaning home. One cannot have a sound economy that is not also sound ecologically. Nor can we study ecology if we ignore the economics of nature.
Energy crisis. How can you be? Energy crisis. How can you be? In a country rich as we. In a country rich as we. How can you be?